Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Renee Garfinkel, your host on the New Books Network with the Van Leer Institute series on ideas. Today, we'll be talking with Adrian Boas about his new book, The Crusader World. Professor Boas is a lecturer in archaeology and history of the Crusader period at the University of Haifa, Israel. He is also the current president of the Society for the Study of the Crusades and the Latin East. Professor Boas has published several books on the archaeology of the Crusader period, most recently the award-winning Montfort, Early History and Recent Studies of the Principal Fortress of the Teutonic Order in the Latin East. Adrian Boas, welcome to the show.
Thank you. A pleasure to be here.
Before we begin, tell us a little bit about yourself. What drew you to your field of study?
Well, I grew up in Australia, so rather distant from Crusader studies, and I didn't really become interested in the topic until I began my university studies, which was fairly late in my early 30s. And prior to that, I'd worked in other fields. I'd been a graphic artist for a number of years. But I had an interest as a child even in the medieval period, from books I'd read, and this interest remained through my adulthood. So when I came to university, it had been something that I had thought about, although at that specific time, my chief interest had been in more modern history and European history, the beginning of the 20th century. But I studied archaeology and history at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And I was fortunate enough to be able to study under Professor Joshua Prava, who was at the end of his academic career then. And I, for about three or four years, I took classes with him. And he was a wonderful scholar, and he was the founder of Crusader Studies in Israel and a world-renowned scholar of the Crusader period. And his enthusiasm and the fascination that he managed to convey to his students was basically what led me into the path of Crusader studies. And the archaeology I'd always been interested in the tangible history. And so archaeology came fairly naturally to me once I was once I began to study. And at the time, there were no people involved in Crusader archaeology as a full-time research topic, and so in Israel at least, and so I thought this would be a good idea to combine Crusader studies with archaeology and to do something that hadn't been done in Israel to a large degree. So this was basically the way I came into this field.
Good teachers who love their field are incredibly impactful in our lives, aren't they?
Indeed, and I was also fortunate enough to be advised by Professor Prava to continue my studies under a student, former student of his, Professor Benjamin Kedar, who is one of the most important people in the field of Crusader history. And and also very enthusiastic about the type of research I was doing, and so certainly I agree entirely that the quality of our teachers has a great deal to do with the direction we go in and how successful we are in that field.
Absolutely. Well, for listeners who are not yet steeped in the Crusader world, set us up with some background. When, where, and why did the Crusades begin?
Well, the first Crusade, which began the period that we call the Crusader period, took place following a call by the Pope, Urban II, in 1095 to restore to Christian control the holy places that had been under the control of Islam for many centuries. And there was a lot of background to this. There were a lot of different reasons why the Pope's call was so successful, but which I wouldn't have time to go into, obviously, here. But a number of reasons, political reasons and social reasons and economic reasons behind this. But in any case, the call of the Pope led to the First Crusade, which reached Jerusalem in 1099, conquered the city and established the Crusader Kingdom of Jerusalem. And then for the next 200 years, the Holy Land, Assyria, a fairly extensive area from what's today southern Turkey down to the Sinai, was under Frankish control, not consistently, but largely under Frankish control for close to 200 years, and also subsequently Cyprus as well. So putting it very briefly, this is the period we refer to as the Crusader period, and within this period there are ups and downs. Obviously, the big event in the middle of the of this period is the Battle of Hattin, which nearly led to the collapse of the kingdom. And so you have a number of periods of development in different aspects of society, of urban life, of castle building, of art, of all different aspects that are the type of topics that I'm studying. So it's quite a fascinating period with a lot of different aspects to it that can be studied.
What about it is fascinating to you?
Well, practically everything, I think. My own personal interest is in material culture, in the changes that were made by Crusader society, or as we say, Frankish society, in adapting themselves to a new situation. So we have a European society that's come and left its former way of life and settled in a region which is quite different, and with a different culture and with different threats and with different elements of life that have to be dealt with on a daily basis. And the reaction to this, to these changes, and the way the Frankish society adapted, adopting things from what they saw around them, bringing things with them from the West and changing them and evolving them. These are the things that fascinate me the most. I think this aspect of how a society has moved from one place to another and how it adapts and survives.
In some parts of the world, in popular culture, the word Crusades conjures up images of knights in shining armor, codes of chivalry, and the like. For Muslims and Jews, on the other hand, the Crusades are remembered as a time of brutality, of wanton murder of civilians, infidels, under the banner of the church, kind of like Christian ISIS-style jihad. And until the Nazi Holocaust in the 20th century, the worst persecutions of European Jews were inflicted by the Crusaders. The Rhineland massacres of 1096 are particularly notorious as brutality marked the travel of the Crusaders on their way to the Holy Land. Is there a scholarly concept of the time period that's expansive enough to include both images of the time?
Is there a, not quite sure I follow the question. Is there a...
I'm wondering if there's a way of talking about the Crusader period that includes the productive, benign, cultural aspects of life, as well as the brutal, hostile, aggressive aspect.
Well, yeah, of it. I mean, obviously scholars have different outlooks and deal with different aspects of, I mean, both of these aspects are there. There's obviously, you know, warfare is very central to the Crusades and not just to the Crusades themselves, but to life in the Latin East. It's a continual thing that's going on. And there's a tremendous amount of brutality on both sides. So obviously these are areas of interest that have weight and importance and are studied by scholars who, for example, in my field, deal with warfare or with fortifications and things like this, or even the social aspects of living in a society under threat. Obviously, these are topics that are researched by a lot of people and are very central to the topic of the Crusader period. At the same time, there is a society which has, has resettled in a different region and is undergoing aspects of change in order to adapt to that region. And my own interest is perhaps more to that side of the picture, to how people adapted and how they evolved their daily life. And I've always had a fascination. My PhD was on domestic life and houses. And so my own personal outlook is, well, I mean, I see both sides of the picture, and I think that both of these aspects of the Crusader existence are important and central, but they're both important. And so also daily life and what people ate and what they wore and how they prayed and how they painted their walls and whatever else, you know, all these are important as well. So, yeah, there's a dialogue for both of these aspects of the topic.
Yes, your chapter is refreshing in its focus on domestic life in a historical period generally characterized by battlefields and church issues. So tell us, what have archaeological findings in the Israeli city of Acre taught us about the daily life in that Crusader urban center?
Well, Acre, certainly a great deal. The history of Acre is central to understanding the Latin East, and certainly the aspects that I have dealt with on domestic life and so forth. But not just the life, daily life, but also the whole economic survival of the kingdom and the development of commerce in the Eastern Mediterranean, and much more than that. And the importance of Acre relates to largely to us today as scholars studying the city and studying the period. It relates to how it was destroyed, in fact, and how it ended. Because unlike Jerusalem, which in 1244 was conquered the last time, it fell once in 1187 after the Battle of Hattin to Saladin, but it fell again. It was recovered by the Franks for a short period and fell finally in 1244. But the city was not destroyed. People continued to live in it. The Franks were kicked out, but there were still Christians and there were Jews and there were Muslims, obviously. And the city survived and the houses survived and over time deteriorated, were rebuilt. So it's quite different from what happened in Acre, because what happened in Acre was that in 1291, the Mamluks conquered the city, and their policy was to destroy whatever they conquered so that there would be nowhere that the Franks could come back to, that a new crusade could reconquer and reuse. So the city was dismantled very thoroughly and left as a pile of ruins. But it was exactly this destruction which preserved the city for us today, because the ground stories, of the lower the basements and the lower parts of the buildings, were buried under the rubble. And when the city of Akko, the city that we know today, was resettled in the late 18th century and developed in the 19th century and was fortified and rebuilt, and the port was reestablished, the buildings were built on the ruins. They weren't cleared away. So whatever had survived from the destruction of 1291 was preserved almost intact underneath the city. And so we have basically an underground city. It's rather like Pompeii, Middle Eastern Pompeii, if you like. And so as archaeologists study it and get down into those lower parts and they uncover covered streets, intact stories of houses, buildings, installations, and so forth, a whole world of medieval life is being uncovered. And I mean, anyone who's visited Akko today and has seen the work carried out by the Israel Antiquities Authority and the other institutions involved in developing Akko can see how enormous the importance of Akko is in understanding Crusader society. It's perhaps the best preserved Crusader city in existence anywhere.
So tell us about, what do we know about the basics of sanitation, water use, health, and how people earned a living?
Well, a great deal, and we're constantly learning more and more. As I say, my PhD, which I did under Professor Kedar and which I subsequently published in a book called Domestic Settings, deals with houses, basically. And Akko is full of houses. There are a lot of other houses in the country, in villages and in other towns, but particularly in Akko. And in these houses, we find preserved often both the material culture, which relates to daily life in the house, if it's the pottery they use to eat from, or if it's the coins they used, or fragments of clothing and other objects relating to daily activities. But also we have institutions that relate to urban life in general. For example, not just in Akko, we have the ports, we have the hospitals, we have sewage systems, we have water supplies, we have cemeteries. And obviously, you know, ruins that have remained over several hundred years, we don't have everything we have, but we have a great deal of information that we can work on, and we're constantly building on this and expanding our understanding of how life was carried out in these cities. So, for example, the wonderful work that's been done on the hospital in Jerusalem, more and more knowledge on the sewage systems and on the water supplies in the different cities and in villages as well, not just in the cities. I had the opportunity of excavating a Crusader village, a European-style village built by Frankish settlers, probably on behalf of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, in what's today the suburb of Ramot in Jerusalem. And from an examination of these houses, you could learn about how people lived, the conditions of their houses, the type of activities they were involved in agriculture and in manufacture of wine and oil and other agricultural produce, and also aspects of the administration of the village. So there's a whole range of things that we can learn from archaeological study in cities and in towns that relate to daily life.
Since you mentioned Jerusalem, I'm curious about how they handled, that is the Crusaders, handled a challenge that Jerusalem still faces, which is the seasonal crowds of pilgrims. It's a challenge today. What was it like then? Did they have any particular way of managing it?
Indeed. Yes, obviously, pilgrimage, which was medieval tourism, if you like, was central to many aspects of life in the Latin East. And I think And this is the outlook I took when I wrote a book on Jerusalem, Jerusalem in the Time of the Crusades. And my understanding from examining the aspect of pilgrimage in Jerusalem, and it's not just in Jerusalem, but it obviously centers on Jerusalem, is that it was vital. It was what turned the city from basically a ghost town at the beginning of the 12th century into a vibrant and vital and lively city by the middle of the years of the century. And the reason for this is that when Jerusalem was conquered in 1099, the Muslim and Jewish population were either slaughtered or kicked out of the city, and very few of the Christians remained. So the city was empty, and there were various things done to revive the city. But perhaps more than anything else, I mean, for example, that people from other areas were brought in and settled in the town. But more than anything else, it was pilgrimage and all the things around pilgrimage that enabled the city to revive. For example, the churches were rebuilt. The conditions for pilgrims were improved by setting up hospitals, markets selling cooked food for the pilgrims visiting. In the center of Jerusalem, there was a street called the Street of Bad Cooking, which basically meant junk food. So this was a street selling food specifically for pilgrims coming to the city. Industries that produced objects that pilgrims would purchase. So a whole range of things making pilgrimage attractive, and together with this, and this is most important, the establishment in Jerusalem in the beginning of the 12th century of the military orders, first the Templars and the Hospitallers and later on other military orders. And these organizations, among other things that they did, which were very important, defended the roads, so made pilgrimage safer. And this was critical in the early years of the kingdom when the roads were very dangerous. And also provided within the cities establishments that dealt with all the needs of pilgrims, and not least hospitals, of course, but many other things as well. And so the efforts made to make the cities attractive, and particularly Jerusalem attractive, by a tremendous amount of building and the establishment of these different installations, together with the making pilgrimage safer, and of course at the ports, making providing the needs of pilgrims arriving at the ports and travel up to the city and so forth, all of these came together to make pilgrimage to give a tremendous boost to pilgrimage. And the result of this was people settling in the city to look after the pilgrims' needs and to make money from it as well. So Jerusalem was basically resettled largely through this, and you have waves of pilgrims coming in, particularly in the holy during the festivals, but also during the travel seasons. There were two seasons a year when ships came to the ports of the Holy Land, and then waves of pilgrims would come up to Jerusalem and to other holy cities. So definitely this is a very central aspect to life in the Latin East, and particularly in the holy cities, and particularly in Jerusalem, pilgrimage is very, very central. And one of the things you mentioned about how the Franks provided or made for these big waves, how they managed this. One of the things you can see this in very clearly is in the rebuilding of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which had been largely destroyed at the beginning of the 11th century by the Muslims. And the Franks rebuilt it. And obviously this was a matter of prestige and a matter of religious importance, but they chose a design which was ideal for large numbers of pilgrims arriving at the church. It was a sort of a circular movement through the church from one point to another, without any sort of blockage. You can still get the effect of this today. The design was a European design of what's known as a Romanesque pilgrim church, where you enter one side and you come out the other, but you have all these different locations where you can pray. So even in the architecture, you can see how the Frankish society was taking into account the expectation and the reality of large waves of pilgrims coming into the city and how to deal with it.
You mentioned the Templars. They were an example of the military communities of monastic rule, were they not? This was an invention of Crusader society?
Yes, the Templars, the Knights of the Temple, were the first military order. It was a small group of knights who had probably come during the First Crusade and settled in Jerusalem. And around the year 1119, they established this organization where they combined military activities as knights with a monastic lifestyle. And the advantage of this is that in a monastery, life is very neatly organized into boxes between hours of prayer. And there's six different hours of prayer. And in between, you had different activities. And in a normal monastery, these would be relating to different activities related to life in the monastery or perhaps agriculture or other things like that. In a military order, they introduced into these spaces between the prayers activities relating to military needs, such as looking after equipment, military practice, and so forth. And so the result of this was an organization of knights who had a very organized lifestyle, who were living in a system where they were daily carrying out exercises and looking after equipment. And in addition to this very neat organization, which made for very disciplined and well-prepared soldiers, these organizations received a tremendous amount of wealth from donations given mainly in the West. And this wealth was pumped into these organizations so they could build castles and bigger castles, and they could provide the best equipment. And the end result is that you have soldiers who are extremely well prepared and also have the very best and up-to-date equipment and are ready for fighting. And that's why the Templars in the first place and later on the Hospitallers and the Teutonic Orders and other military orders were the best fighters. They were the best elements, the strongest in the armies, because they were so well prepared and so well equipped.
And did they think of themselves, or did the rest of society think of them as holy warriors?
Well, I suppose they did. I mean, because they're combining these two elements, they are obviously warriors, and they're also consistently involved in their daily routine. They have six different periods of prayer. So obviously there are these aspects. That doesn't mean that they're all these saintly people. You know, they're warriors, and they're quite aggressive, and they're often very barbaric in their behavior. But yes, I suppose these organizations as a whole were regarded as holy warriors, if you like.
Tell us a little more about what archaeology informs us about the interior household life of the ordinary people. What did they eat? How did they cook? Tell us about the women's lives. Give us a picture of the ordinary people in contrast to the Templars, just the regular folks who resettled here.
Yes, well, we have a lot of information as coming through from archaeological research on what people wore and what they ate and how they cooked and how they, the different industries they were involved in or activities in the household that they were involved in. There are also a lot of gaps in this information. There are a lot of things that don't survive the years, and so we have to sort of fill in from what we can understand from the archaeological record, combined with what evidence we have in written sources. And fortunately, one of the wonderful things of dealing with a late period of history, like the Crusader period, comparatively late to what a lot of other archaeologists in the country are dealing with, is that we have a tremendous amount of written information as well. and in either in texts written by his chroniclers or by pilgrims or by others. And this, even a pilgrim who comes to the Latin East and visits Jerusalem, he's not only going to the church, he's going through the markets and he's seeing daily life in the city. And not always, but quite often you get a lot of information from these sources as well. And even from documents in archives that, for example, when I wrote my book on the domestic life and houses, I was able to take information from written sources about how about pollution, about crowding in the cities, about the cost of housing, the rental and purchase costs of houses in Acre, for example. So there's a lot of information, written information as well. In archaeological information, there are areas where we have a lot more information and there are areas where we have a lot less. So, for example, cooking, well, we have the ceramic vessels that we use for cooking. We know that in a Frankish household, just as in other medieval households in the region, people cooked their meals in cooking pots glazed with a lead glaze. So they were also slowly poisoning themselves, but they were not aware of the fact. We have today, there are ways also of tracing material that's preserved in the vessels so that you might get an idea of what they were actually cooking. And for example, in my excavations in a, albeit a castle, not in a house context, but in the Montfort Castle, we get a lot of bones and surviving, say, seeds and things like that, that give us evidence about the actual meals they were having. We are able sometimes to observe things like, and this, there's a chapter in the book that the Crusader World by a former MD turned biological anthropologist, Piers Mitchell, about the diseases that people had, often resulting from what they were eating. So, for example, analyzing waste taken from latrines and cesspits, he was able to show what types of tapeworms they were, or ringworms, or roundworms, or whatever they were suffering from, and these related to how they cooked their meals, for example. So there are all different aspects of how we can recover the daily life through examining different types of materials. There are, as I say, some things that we're less informed on from the archaeological record. For example, clothing. To get a vague idea of what clothing is like in illuminations in manuscripts, and there are fragments of metal pieces from buckles and things like that from clothing, but there's very little in the way of actual clothing that survives. We did find there was a shoe and a sandal found in Montfort Castle, not by our excavation, but earlier on, but very few pieces of actual clothing. So that's an area where we have a little bit less information, for example.
Well, we're speaking together today under conditions of social distance and nearly lockdown because of the coronavirus. So I'm wondering what we know about the leisure activities that the Crusaders enjoyed.
Yes. Well, we do have some information on that, largely from... not so much from private houses, more from institutions like monasteries and military order castles, where we often find evidence of games that have been played, board games, a game named Nine Man's Morris.
Board games. Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And dice and game pieces, for example. So we know people were doing that. You also get things like, for example, graffiti on walls, people doodling, passing their time scribbling on the walls and things like that. So there are these little bits of evidence about leisure activities. Another area that is particularly interesting regarding leisure is the use of the bathhouse, which was adopted by the European settlers on a much larger scale, perhaps, than they had used bathhouses in Europe. And it became a very central element in daily life. And from some sources, for example, Muslim sources describing Franks in the bathhouse, and from Frankish sources as well, we find that they are making use of bathhouses and staying there overnight even, and sometimes having their meals in bathhouses. So bathing was another big leisure activity that was taken on by the Frankish settlers.
Well, that's really interesting. When and how did the Crusader movement come to an end?
Well, if we're talking about the Syrian states, the Principality of Antioch and the Tripoli and the Kingdom of Jerusalem, it came to an end at the end of the 13th century. And in Cyprus, it continues on for some time. The fall of the Kingdom of Jerusalem, well, it basically begins earlier on. The big beginning of the descent, if you like, is the Battle of Hattin in 1187, when Saladin has united the Arab countries around the kingdom and around the Crusader states, and he eventually gets them to come face-to-face in a field battle at the Horns of Hattin in the eastern Galilee, and defeats virtually the entire Frankish army or Crusader army. And as a result of this, the kingdom collapses very rapidly within a few months. Only the town of Tyre, the coastal town of Tyre, remaining in Frankish hands. And then there's a third crusade, and the coast is recovered. And then there are various agreements that briefly return Jerusalem to the Christian rule and the Galilee. But the decline really begins at Hattin, which is a watershed in Crusader history. So there are ups and downs after that. The big decline comes in the 1260s with the rise of the new dynasty in Egypt, the Mamluks, and the invasion by their sultan, the Baybars, who is the person who introduces this, what I mentioned before, this system of conquering and destroying Crusader castles, Crusader towns, and he comes up the coast and destroys places like Al-Suf and Acre. And he attacks the castle I work on at Montfort, and he goes up north and takes other castles. And this is the beginning of the collapse, and it just builds up from that point on. So through the later half of the 13th century, you have the Crusader settlement shrinking more and more towards Acre and a few coastal towns until 1291, May 1291, when Acre falls, and that's basically the end. They hang on until August, and the last Franks depart from the kingdom at Lit in August 1291.
And what would you say were some ways the Crusader movement impacted the future?
Well, there are ways in it impacted the future. It had an influence on a lot of different things. Industries and various industries. I think perhaps the most illustrative one is something that's very much with us today, not a favorable thing perhaps, although it's still viewed by many people as such, and that's the use of sugar. Because sugar was an industry which manufacture sugar existed before the Crusades, but it was the Crusades and within the Crusader Kingdom of Jerusalem that the refining of sugar became an organized industry and an important export product. And the military orders were largely involved in this. And they developed a way of refining sugar, and they regarded it as a very healthy article that had great benefits. Today, it's regarded by some people as one of the most dangerous drugs to humanity. And so sugar is very much with us today, and it's largely because of what happened in the Latin Kingdom of Jerusalem in the 12th century. Obviously, later on, it went through all sorts of other, went to other places and moved on and developed, but that's where it really began as an industry. So that's one example. It's a rather
it's an amusing one.
Amusing when, one indeed.
And you think of how much it's blamed on sugar today.
Yes. Yeah. But I mean, obviously there are other things, but a lot of the things that were important at the time are no longer important to us. For example, castle building obviously is no longer something. Yeah, you know, it was very central at the time, but it's not something that affects our life today in any way. But yes,
not like sugar.
Unlike sugar,
we love our sugar. Yeah. So, in all your years of exploring archaeologically and studying historically, are there any particular moments that stand out to you where a discovery or an insight just moved you more than other times?
Well, almost every season of excavation, I've been working at Montfort Castle since 2006 and excavating since 2011. And we've had 10 archaeological excavation seasons. Unfortunately, this year, it looks like we're going to have to put it off because of the current crisis. But almost every season has been has produced a remarkable find or evidence for something very dramatic in our understanding of the castle. And throughout my career, obviously, you know, I've worked in different castles. I worked in a castle in the Upper Jordan Valley, Vadim Yakov or Shastele at Geshev Not Yakov, a remarkable castle with an extraordinary history. And there are always finds that are amazing and moving. I think for me, if I look back on all my career, the archaeological find that was perhaps most moving for me emotionally was not to do with the Crusades, but it was when I was working on the site of Dor, Tantura, on the coast. And I was directing a field in the excavations, and we came across a step, I think it was a stone step, and there was a brace or a necklace lying there on the step as if somebody had placed it there 2,000 years or 3,000 years ago. I don't remember the details now, but I mean the metal of the bracelet or the necklace had completely deteriorated, but the beads were there just laid as they'd been placed on the step. So that was like a very touching and something that really gave you, as I say, a tangible sense of history. And obviously, when we find a coin, when we're dusting and we find something that somebody's put and it's exactly where it was placed in the case of Crusader sites 800 or 900 years ago, it's very moving and very emotional. But it's not always these things that are important. Sometimes it's something very banal, something very minor that has a dramatic importance to understanding of a site. But there are just so many different things that I found interesting and fascinating and important through my
finding that bracelet must have been thrilling.
Yeah, it was.
Could just
very
imagine the person putting it, the woman putting it down.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh. And thinking about the circumstances why it remained there.
Yeah. Right, it's like the beginning page of a novel.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Adrian, I've taken up a lot of your time, and I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
Before you go, though, tell us what you're working on now.
Well, I'm at the end of my career as not the end of my career, perhaps, but at the end of my academic career. I'm now on a half sabbatical, and I retire at the end of this year.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. Not that I won't miss teaching, because I thoroughly enjoyed teaching, and I've had the good fortune of having a lot of wonderful students, many of whom are now involved in Crusader archaeology as well. But what I want to do now, at least in the immediate future, is to do something to bring for the general public, to get the public here in Israel, for example, where it's often the case that people either know nothing or don't really care or find Crusader history something they don't want to deal with. And I want to change these attitudes, but also in general to reach a much broader public than I have as an academic, where I've written books, but they're generally read by academics and or by students and not by a much broader public. So I have in mind a book which I've been working on for the past particularly 2 years, but just on the side, and now I will have more time to deal with it, on the relationship between the Crusaders and the Crusader settlers, but at the beginning of the Crusader period, and the Italian merchant fleets, and how these two very different groups got together and worked in unison as a very, very important alliance in which enabled the conquering of the coast and the survival, the subsequent survival and development of the Crusader states, but also on the Italian side, gave them a much stronger hold on relationships, on commercial relationships between the East and the West. And so I think this alliance between the Crusaders and the Italians would eventually have a very strong impact on Europe, and much more so than some scholars have said in the past. And so this is a book that I want to write as a trade book, as a book for a general public rather than as an academic book. And in order to do this, and as is required today when you're writing the book for the trade, and one has to set up a what's known as an author's platform, some sort of in presence in the media or in the internet and so forth. So I've been writing a post for the, a blog for the past year and a half. I've written over 200 posts on aspects of the Crusades, which I interweave with modern things in the news today, for example, the coronavirus, if you like, or don't like, or aspects of personal things in my life, in my childhood, and a bit of humour to try and reach a broader audience, but always with this section on or how it relates to the past and to the Crusader past specifically. So often finding this, the way these two things fit together, you know, how the past relates to the present and so forth. And I thoroughly enjoy doing it, and I write two posts a week generally. So that's basically what I'm working on now, along with obviously the excavations that are going to be going on, hopefully after the present crisis is overcome, and my work in the Society for the Study of the Crusades in the Latin East, and various other work with students. Certainly continue to work with PhD students.
Well, that sounds like a great project, and this podcast will be happy to find a home on your blog, because it fits right in with your goal of spreading the word to people who are not necessarily specialists in the field. Adrian, I want to thank you for taking the time and being on the show today. And thanks to our researcher, Bela Pasikoff.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.